Okay, I think we can start. My name is Efren Edwards. I'm from the Office Content Publishing Group. I'm here with Sonia Acheson and Mike Plumley, and we're here to facilitate this Chalk Talk and Q&A session. This is one of three Chalk Talks, and this one is centered on running your PMO with Project Web App and Project Professional. And these esteemed gentlemen up front are all Microsoft internal people that work with project engineering from the engineering team, MCS. We also have Brian Kennemer. So during the session, we'll give you the unique opportunity to come up and ask questions directly from this panel. But to start it off, we tried to come up with five common questions that we hear over and over again. And each one of the experts here is going to address one of those questions. And here they are. And for the first question, how much can I accomplish with just SharePoint? When do I really need Project Web App and Project Professional? And for this first question, Brian's going to answer it.
So a good question. Is the microphone working? Can you hear me? Good. There's quite a bit. I mean, it really depends on the complexity of your project as to where you really want to get to, and also probably the I always feel bad saying the maturity of your organization, because it sounds as if, you know, you're immature doesn't sound like the right thing to say about people that have paid to come to a conference. But again, that's part of it as well. If you can't, if you're not used to that level of project management using Project Professional and that particular tool, then you might just be better staying with SharePoint lists and that kind of thing. So there is a good entry point with SharePoint to just use a task list, and you're assigning those tasks to people and you're checking them off. When you start getting more complex projects and you've got relationships between those tasks, then that soon becomes the place where you want to start using Project Professional. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you need to go straight to Project Online at that stage, or even to Project Server 2013 if you're sort of tied into the on-premises world. You could still use Project Pro for Office 365 or Project Professional 2013 just connected to SharePoint. So you're saving your project to a task list. And that gives you the ability to use the rich functionality of Project Professional to do sort of a higher level of project management and more complex things, more assignments. Perhaps if you've got a very long project, for instance, you probably wouldn't want to work in the schedule web part. There's plenty you can do in the schedule web part, but it's a little bit like having a financial analyst. You know, they could use the Excel web app, or they could use Excel on their desktop. And chances are, if they've got 500,000 rows, they're going to be using Excel on their desktop and not the Excel web app. It's exactly the same with Project. There's stuff you can do on the web, there's stuff you can do with the client, and you just have to choose when one of those works better for you than the other. So that's like the second step. You're using Project Pro, but you're still saving to a task list. And your other SharePoint colleagues can then see those tasks in the task list and can work on those as well. And then the next place up is when you go for Project Online. And probably you'll make that jump when you're looking at a portfolio of projects. So you're not just interested in that project. You're more interested in how that project interrelates with all your other projects. If you've got resources, for instance, that are being shared across those projects, or you need to see sort of the all-up portfolio of those projects coming through as well. So there's different levels will suit different companies, and suit different companies at their different maturity level as well. So they might sort of want to start sort of at the easy level and get a feel for how they're going to be managing projects as they move more to more complexity. They can sort of move up the scale to Project Pro and then to Project Online, again using Project Pro. So anybody else got any other thoughts on other decisions you might use to choose which one to go for?
Sounds good.
And Brian, I'm sorry, I forgot to do intros. Could you just say something about yourself? Okay.
I could say something about myself. I'm an escalation engineer. I work in the global business support team. So I'm sort of tier three, as is Adrian to my right. And we tend to sort of take the nasty, difficult problems. So if you find yourself talking to us, it's probably not for a very good reason. But I apologize for that, but it's the way it goes. So.
We'll try our best, though. I'm Adrian Jenkins. Like Brian said, I work on the third-tier escalation team. And so if you have an interaction or your issue really needs help from the product team, maybe a fix or whatever, I'm typically that guy you'd be working with there as well.
I'm Arvin, and I'm one of the software testers with the project team. And I guess I'm the guy who gets hammered when these guys have problems. And as I said, I work with the test team.
So does this mic work? I'm Chris Boyd. I'm a program manager in the product group, so I work closely with Arvin and, of course, with Adrian and Brian. I guess the two of us are the ones that are delivering the broken pieces that Brian and Adrian have to deal with.
They create the problems. We get to fix it. Yeah.
But hopefully, at the same time, we deliver a bunch of great features that you guys get to use. So.
I'm Brian Kennemer. I am one of the partners. I'm not with Microsoft, but I work with a couple of different partners, and I work with customers often to help get you to these guys and help describe the problem. But I do deployment consulting, and I spent 5 years at Microsoft Consulting Services, actually working with Kevin, doing in the MCS team that did Project Server deployments. And I've worked for several partners. Right now, I do some work with Deltabon, is one of the partners downstairs. And I'm in the MVP program again. So.
Now, just a quick note, there's a guy in the back of the room who actually can attest to this, but Brian was the one that scored the highest score on entry of getting into Microsoft. Extremely hard test, but by the way, but Brian is the one I think holds the record. Is that right, Reed, in terms of that? Yeah. By the way, that test was basically all undocumented stuff. Very, very clever. But my name's Kevin Watson. I'm also... I'm inside with MCS. I do the delivery. Had a conversation with some architects not long ago, and I said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I work for PPM, and I do deployments for the customers." So after the salespeople leave, now I'm the person that works with the customer and actually makes this happen. And he goes, "Oh yeah, we heard there's a few unicorns left." So here I am today. So.
Okay, we'll move to the second question. Okay, our goal is to get through these five questions. We have a mic here. And then you folks can line up and ask questions to this panel. So let's move to the second question. How can we track resource usage and availability to better understand our capacity to do more project work? And I think Kevin is slated to answer this one.
Right. So how many people here are actually doing this right now in your organizations? Or it's certainly important to you? Quite a few, right? So this is typically why why we deploy this for our customers, because they want to have that visibility of the resources themselves. Right, but how you go about that can be problematic, and there's a lot of different ways of approaching this. I think one of the first things you need to do is really identify what is our overall objective with doing this type of activity. And there's you want to take a look at, I think about one of our customers. It was helpful, for example, that they need to know that they're going to hire a nuclear geophysicist 18 months ahead of time, because it takes a while, especially when the government, to hire somebody with that skill set. And they were using Excel spreadsheets at the time, which I think was like 150 megabyte Excel spreadsheets, huge things. So we brought in, we put Project Server, and we started working with some of the out-of-the-box features of this. But at the end of the day, what we were able to do with that is tell them that they needed to hire X number of that type of skill set and role set well beforehand in order to allow them, because they knew of the demand that was coming down the pipeline. And the way that was done essentially is by a concept of generics. So how many are familiar with generics use? So very good. So that's pretty much everyone. So you go. One of the first things you might initially do is identify what those generics are within the organization, what types of roles of the people they are. You're going to tag the individuals to the one-to-one relationship, generally what we call roles. That sometimes gets confused with skills, which is a whole other capability that we could talk about later. But just a real quick thing on as far as skills go, just doing the inventory itself of the various things that a person, the multiple hats or the skills that a person have, can take a little while. But the identifying of what is your primary role, that shouldn't be terribly difficult. So one of the first things when you're looking to do resource usage across your organization is like identify who the individuals are, what are their primary roles. So you do that. Now you want to create in your resource pool, enterprise resource pool that gets put together. So that's composed of the real names, or primarily, you know, two things essentially. The real individuals and then the generic. So we have one-to-one relationships between the generic and a role. Why we use this? Because once you've established what your baseline is and what the actual real resources that you have, when you start to publish projects or other or resource plans or some other things that you might utilize, you would use generics. So you would say, all right, I need to know, or I need five nuclear science, you know, geophysicists for this particular project coming out that's 18 months. And you post that in or publish that in the project. So that helps you see the forecast. Now, in the, you're all probably familiar with the resource availability views that's built in there. That's part of that vehicle. I remember with the one customer, I was almost for 2 years, I get in the elevator and I couldn't get on the elevator without seeing the, especially the branch chiefs holding this resource availability view in their hands, trying to figure out all the peaks and valleys and how they're going to solve that. So it became a very integral part of what people's daily activities are. But I'll just whiteboard that a little bit quick for you that haven't seen it. So you've got overall capacity. So for a team of people, let's say you have 10 individuals, 40 hours a week standard work, so you have 400 hours total capacity here. And what you want to do is, I said, you want to identify what is the actual work in the organization. Now, typically when you go to put this in place in many of your organizations, it was usually brought in from the standpoint of projects, right? We got Microsoft project and individual projects. So that's a component that people generally first to start to identify. But what about the people who are not on projects, right? And all the work that individuals, many of you may be assigned to projects, but you also have other roles that you play or other hats that you wear. So you determine what this overall capacity is, because I would make the argument that not any individual is going to be assigned to just 100% effort on a single project or multiple projects, right? You still got to do your meetings. You still have to go to your training sessions. So those type of things are what I call like non-project work. So you want to account for that, and there's some vehicles of which you would use to treat that. But so you look at trying to track up to that capacity for the most part. And generally, ballpark, you could say, well, 20% is admin, right, to allow for that, the other component that wouldn't be projects. And then individual projects start to get published, and you would see what that is. And you're looking to see, once you start to cross this line, and how much demand, right? So if you use generics, for an example, that would like to publish and it puts you beyond, because you only had real 10 bodies, but now you see that you've published additional projects or additional information that shows you that you've got a forecasted demand. Am I making sense to you all so far? Okay. So there's that non-project component and the project component that you want to take a look at. Now, how you do this administrative, there's a couple of ways that you could go about that. You can use something that's called resource plans. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you can publish those in there pretty quickly. You can create actual MPP files. But so you start to take an inventory, you take a look at what your organization has in consideration of the non-project time. Because, well, the other approach is, you could have also said this capacity line here is not 100%. You could have dropped it down and say maybe it's 75 or maybe it's 80%. And you could just start with the capacity line. So that's one way of treating it as well. Personally, I kind of like having the administrative or the resource plan show up in here, because it shows up as one of the boxes that stacks up in place. Now, that backfired on me with one of the customers, well, actually, when I was before with Microsoft, which is like about 9 years ago, my manager at the time, I was making the argument, see, I've got more work than there is in me. And what she did is she went over here and unchecked the box over here for administrative plan and dropped it all down. So gotta be careful about the visibility of that. The other component is, so it's a little bit hard in how you deploy. So what I generally do with a lot of the customers is, use this walk, crawl, walk, run scenario. And often you'll start with the project managers themselves. So the first thing I say, even if they don't know how to create an MPP file, which in some cases that's where we start from, you have them publish a project and they account for their time that they're spending against that project. So you can publish one line. So they start on this project and say 1 year later it goes to this date. And then I have them assign themselves a certain percentage of their day or the week toward that. And so all those get published in here and they start to stack up here. And now you see what the availability is. A current customer, that's a very real scenario. They had 100 plus projects coming down the pike and there's only 10 of these project managers. So that was the first bottleneck in that organization they had to deal with. Is if they're going to take more on projects, did they even have a project manager to manage it? Forget the rest of the resources they haven't identified yet, just even the project managers. And since those are the critical component of which then will actually publish the information, the data that goes in the tool is your MPP files. So it's real important to get the project managers to fundamentally understand and account for their own time before you have them do it for the rest of your organization, because they'll start to be assigned to the different tasks and so forth in projects. That makes sense? So get the project managers first is the best thing I can say in terms of getting them to understand that. And because they're part of that whole, the loop and the cycle, that's the first person you want to train, understand that. The other component would be, so you got the projects. Yeah, so the other thing you do is when you start to do the resource plans, you'd say that non-project work, so a lot of people are like managers and so forth. You have supervision. You decide what we call sometimes call as buckets. And you can publish those in an organization. So you do an inventory of the different people or the different branches or parts of your organization, and you can say what percentages you come back. Some organizations call this like a manpower study. In the military, they call it troop to task. And they'll identify, here are all the individuals, and these are the types of hats that they wear. And so these are, or functional areas, as they sometimes call them, right? So they put a spreadsheet together, and here's all the individuals by the branch. And then they had, we put in the columns there on this Excel spreadsheet that they have. They put in the columns for each of these line items. And then they said, all right, they're going to work 20% administrative, 50% this, and 50%, or what am I at now? 20% to the remaining, so up to 100%. So you get these spreadsheets. And what we did with this is to take each of those columns that was in the spreadsheet, and we published an individual MPP file. And in there, it's the criteria that I generally use is one task, one individual. Right? And so you're looking at forward forecasting. So for I'll put in there and publish for 1 year forward, how much percentage? So you're going to use units, right, to assign toward that to that. So that also will then show up in here and stack up. So if you're looking at trying to start off with an organization, here's 100% of where capacity and where it's assigned, you can do that as well. And then when you start to add the generic aspect of it, that shows you to help you. You know, when you make the argument, I need more of X, right? You already show that the people already assigned these various elements. So there's that approach as well. So any additional questions, follow-ups? Yes, sir. Yeah, you need to hire more, correct, right, if you want it within that week, correct.
So now I need to replace those five generic resources with named individuals. And of course, in the dialogue, in the resource dialogue, you can do a match.
Right.
You can only do a single replacement.
The people have that correct for that skill or that role.
So not only can you only do a single replacement, but you can't say, I need this to be automatically contoured to the resource availability.
Mm-hmm. You're that product group?
Yeah, that's excellent feedback. We're listening as you.
Going back to the first bit.
Yeah.
What's your recommendation around? This is a question we get all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What's your recommendation on how they deal with that product? We've got various answers, but I'm not sure about
that. So, if I understand the essential nutshell of it, is any of you guys pick up on exactly what we're.
One way that you can do that, and I think the crux of it is that you've got a single generic resource assignment, but you want to, but you've got it at 500%, so you want to mm-hmm. go find the five people that are going to do that and bring it in. And it's really easy when it's a one-to-one, because you can just say, basically swap these two or match them and replace. And obviously you can't do that. You can't replace a single generic with multiple, or you can't replace a single resource with multiple resources. It's not just that it's generic. What you can end up doing is do some filtering. You can kind of build your own. It won't address necessarily the specifics of the resource contouring of that generic, but you can filter it out, and then you can just hand assign, add those five team members to the project. Just bring them over in the add resources from Enterprise. Bring them in. Filter the view so it's only showing the task that your generic was assigned to, and then assign your five resources to the tasks that were there, and then remove the generic. And again, it gets you there. It's not quite as elegant as just doing the match, and it won't do the contouring if you had a finely contoured generic. But it'll at least get you there without.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's the manual approach. It works, but yeah.
Very, very cool.
Oh. Yeah, it'd be super cool.
How many hours, if I've got five generics, I've got five individual resources, how many hours do I want to associate? And then I can just pick the five
Yeah. But it starts sounding that.
It's chrisboyd@microsoft.com.
that would be correct.
At that branch level, if you envision me here for a second, let's say I'm a SQL manager and I've got 10 people working for me, and I know what this thing currently shows me, if I got the work that's currently reflected in there, say it's up to here and I have some capacity, and then you can look at the individual so you know which ones are assignable. But now you've got the demand beyond, so you got to figure out how do I get additional people. Yes, sir. Yeah, so we typically do that, and sometimes so even within multiple branches. So for project managers, it might be other departments. I have generics for the individual departments because I assign them in the RBS. So when you go in here and look at this demand, are you going to claim that's the RBS I'm looking for? As a project manager to be hired over here, as opposed to project managers over there? Same skill set, but yet it's the same role, but it's now tied to RBS because it's easier to tie it into when you're trying to match that back to the branch that those people would come from, or the demand is coming from.
But the generic one, generic two makes sense in theory, but it doesn't always scale very nicely, and it works real good for generic one and generic two, but once you get to about generic 15, it starts to get, because then it's like, which one of those generics do I assign? And you've got one of the generics with massive, because that's just the one that they picked, and everybody put it on generic three. And it, depending on how you're doing it. So generic three is super overbooked, and then you end up having to add another field that says that has a property, so you can aggregate all the show me a report with all the generic developer X's that have this field equal to this value, so you can aggregate them together because now you've got 10 of them instead of one, and you can rat hole yourself pretty easily doing that though.
Right.
You want to be very careful.
I've seen generic creation to where it's down to, so typically some organizations will hire contractors to fill certain roles, and the generic will say generic contractor XYZ, and you might create some of those that you would use to plug in as well.
Sounds like there are a lot of great ideas here for how to do this better, and we certainly understand that. Kelvin, there's a person that you could talk to, and I can get you in touch with him, because he's looking for all of these types of ideas right now.
Okay, maybe we should move on to the next question.
Yeah, I would say real quickly this. I mean, there's quite a few other sessions. I think the other partners have written some advanced tools that help augment the out-of-the-box capability that drills down into this component, because it's very important to a lot of organizations, right? So, we only take it at a certain level. Again, I would probably encourage you to take a look at some of the other partner solutions. There's quite a few out there that help leverage and add capability here.
Okay, thank you. Going forward, I ask that you kind of hold your questions till we get through all five of these, because I want to make sure that everyone that came in here, at least we can answer as many questions as we can before the session ends. So for the third question, how can we track our overall spending on projects to better understand our ability to do more with our budgeted dollars? And Brian is slated to answer that one.
All right, I got the, yeah.
I was panicking for a minute.
That's right. So yeah, I got the easiest question. This will only take like 10 seconds, so we're all good. Cost, so the good news is that you can get a long ways with project doing on cost, but one thing we always end up having to talk about at some point down the level of maturity is that project is not a cost, is not a full cost accounting system. You can track some costs, you can track rates and those kinds of things, but if you're looking for full project accounting, there are whole companies that do just that, or whole divisions of Microsoft that do just that. But project is primarily a scheduling engine for doing task and resource management, but it does obviously have some good inroads into the cost area. One of them is just straight assigning resource to tasks, and it ends up going a long way hand in hand with what Kevin talked about. Where some people end up with some problems is the level of detail. They want down to the penny cost, yet they want to assign their resources at this very broad level because they don't know exactly how many hours someone's going to work. And so it's somewhere in between those you end up with a point at which there's an acceptable bit of fuzziness in your schedule and in your cost. And normally with scheduling, you can be a little fuzzy. People are okay with that. But as soon as you put a dollar sign in front of something, suddenly they want it down to the cent. And so you definitely want to be careful with what level of detail that you're going to build your overall project model, assigning your resources, because to a large extent, the costing features in project are directly related to the resources that you're doing. There are things like fixed cost fields in project. I tend to try not to use fixed cost. I tend to try and do with resources. Now, with cost resources, obviously we've come a long way with being able to model costs that aren't necessarily related to how many hours someone worked, and so cost resources. There's budget resources. If you want to go to the high level, the pre baseline of being able to model your costs at a very high level, and then. But essentially, it's down at the resource level, and it goes directly to what level of detail you want to build your model at. There's cost rate tables, because it's the slippery slope. It's how mature are you at modeling these things, and then you've got I've got Kevin. He is often an architect for Project Server, but occasionally he writes reports. And what if I bill him out at a different rate when he's doing one of those skills over the other? And then you start talking about the project profitability rather than just the spending. And when you're dealing with resource rate, when you think of resource rate, do you mean how much I'm charging someone for it or how much I'm paying Kevin to do it? And there's obviously some things. Project does not have a lot of features that are going to directly relate to profitability and what the difference between what I pay someone and what I charge for them.
And that whole component of blended versus the real rates, that's a big interesting discussion.
Quite comes into security, because then it's like who's allowed to see what I'm paying Kevin as a contractor, mm-hmm. and then you end up having to do a blended rate, so you're aggregating that so no one can figure out what Kevin's making. And And again, once you start going down that road, you get multiple of those kinds of factors in play. Often what ends up needing to happen is thinking about some kind of an integration between Project Server, between the scheduling capabilities of Project Server and whatever accounting system your organization is using. And with the PSI, obviously integration of that kind of data has become much easier to do. There are partners that do a lot of that kind of work of getting data into and out of your accounting systems. So I'm sure there'll be some questions afterwards. That's my little piece, but we'll get the rest of the questions and leave some time for Adrian to help us with the last ones here.
Okay, actually, next to the last question, number four. What reports are available out of the box to support PMO metrics? And that is Arvind answering this.
Just before I answer the question, quick poll of hands. How many people attended the keynote? Okay, cool. So because a lot of my answer actually was already probably presented
cheater,
in the keynote,
cheater.
So I have nothing to answer you, do I? But yeah. Either ways, I mean, for that, obviously, Project 2013, I guess, was a big release for us because we did a lot of investments in reporting in general and particularly client reporting, where we had added a lot of new cool dashboards and reports. And I think a bunch of them already came up in the keynote. Like, there was the project overview dashboard, which is a very quick starter report where you have all the key things in place, looking for the late tasks, the milestones, everything that you want to take a look at in your project is right there in front of you. And then, of course, for resources, I mean, of course, I think a bunch of my colleagues here obviously have alluded how awesome we are at resources. But at least for the starter stuff, we do have reports like work overview, and there are a bunch of other resource reports where you can at least do the basic, how much my resource is available and how is he being utilized for this current project that I'm working on. And then, of course, the new cool addition, that's the burn down. I know that's been the constant feedback that we've been getting, and at last we got to do that in 2013. So those are probably the three key highlights that we have, but do feel free to check and explore. There are tons of other reports in this client that we have added as a part of the 2013 release. And And obviously, needless to say, since this is the same charts, you can export to Excel, do all the fun stuff, make it the way you want to do so. And speaking of Excel, we do have this other reporting infrastructure and client which actually helps you do that. So there is visual reports for people who heard that. That's the old school reports we have which still do a bunch of this reporting where you can export to Excel and then you can play around with the data the way you want to do it and present it. But you can pull all the data from project MPP that you have currently and pull it to Excel, and so you get to do a bunch of pivoting. And we have a similar thing for Visio, so you can, I guess, visualize it the way you want to do so.
I'm curious how many people are using visual reports, the built-in capability.
Okay, few show of hands. I think the new reports are much more cooler, but if you guys do think that there's some data that you really, really want in Excel and you want to do some of those roll-ups and things, I think you may be better off going to Excel than doing so. Awesome. Okay, good. We have somebody who's watching for that. So yeah, everyone. Obviously, if there are any problems, then yeah. I mean, please make sure you share your email. He's the man. I'll definitely get to your question. Just a quick one, if it's a question, just to hold on. But for the server piece, actually, that's the other interesting part. Some of the cross project reporting, obviously, you can go with visual reports and try that out. But if you have project server, there are, and project online as well, we have actually three out-of-the-box reports that we come up with, and one of them is actually the Power View report where you have the project overview dashboard. If you guys have not seen it, I would highly recommend you guys come, and obviously you guys can come to the booth and check out that report. I mean, we have all the data in, and you guys can see how you can look at the data and pivot around it. And for people who have not explored Power View, please do so. It's a really great tool that's come out with this new Excel release, and it's giving you a bunch of this BI that you guys have been looking for all the time. And of course, if you guys are on-prem, I think a bunch of people may have on-prem installations. We have a few other reports, which I really wouldn't call them reports in the sense that they don't really give anything interesting, but they are very great starter reports. Like if you're the guy who's like, you know, hey, I don't know SQL at all, but how do I really get started with it? That's the reports you go with. It's like the first one, hey, how do I do timesheet actuals? How do I do resource capacity? How do I aggregate across projects? How do I do issues and risk? Those basic reports, if you're looking for, they're all out there. So instead of trying to dig up something that's already been done, I would highly recommend go to that out-of-the-box reports, see what's already there available for you, and then make sure you modify those. And those are great starting points. And I know, for on-prem, there is OLAP databases. So if there are people who are building cubes and have OLAP databases, we out-of-the-box provision all the reports for each of those cubes, so you don't have to do a bunch of work there. And of course, if you are having fun times and all our advanced users who are building new cubes and new reports, it's all up to you guys. Nothing out of the box for you guys. But
I would just add to that, I mean, a lot of people fail to realize this, but the project center view, all those views that you see in there, is really your first line of reporting. That's straight, especially from the PMO, right? This is where the portfolio is. So you can just by simply filtering or grouping, and then you know that little button in the icon up there or in the ribbon, you just hit Excel to export to Excel, there's the report. So people sort of forget to fail to realize that's already built in there. And then, you know, Excel services is, you know, when you want to build that ad hoc report out of the box, I can sit down with most people and show them within 10 minutes or less how you can extract that data and create your own report. So it's right there out of the box.
Okay, thank you. And the last of our most common questions: how can I archive projects in a way that will slow? That will still allow reporting. And to answer that, we have Adrian.
Thank you. I think the answer really depends on what kind of visibility you still want to have into those projects. So, in the most easy sense, you would say, "All right, once these projects are completed, I want to just cut off the writable access to those projects." And so through a security category, you could certainly do that. You know, there are ways to do that so that you can start putting projects into these categories where it's basically, I deny any type of writability to, you know, being able to save to this project at any point. You could also look at it that maybe you don't want anyone to view those projects at all, and so that would just be another step in that same process where you would add those projects to a category and you would prevent people from viewing those given projects given the permissions you put onto that category. Now, one thing you need to realize is that if you happen to delete that project from the server thinking, well, I'm done with this thing, it's going to be removed from reporting as well. So in that sense, you need to keep it around. Now, I was recently working with a customer who they create at least a couple hundred projects per week because they're in the IT department and so forth. They're fairly small projects, maybe, you know, 10 to 50 tasks or whatever, and they report on these all the time, and by the end of the week or a couple of weeks, they're done with these projects, and they want to keep them all around for reporting purposes, and that is certainly making it more interesting for them when they go to a place like the Project Center. And for them, I've had to suggest that they certainly look at the categories so that they can filter out all the stuff that they don't want to see. And then long term, I've also suggested to them that they need to figure out, well, how long do we need to keep these projects around for, even for reporting purposes? Do I need to be able to look at them for the last, you know, 3 years or the last 4 or 5 years? You know, what is the cutoff point to the place where I'm finally done with this project and I can delete it and I don't have to worry about it in reporting? I suppose you could also at some point also say, well, if I truly really need that reporting capability for these old projects, I would have the old backups of those databases. So at a certain point, I could back up that database. I would still have the reporting database itself. If you're in 2010, for example, you would have the reporting database and you could still use that as of that point where you said, I'm done with this, and you could use that for other reporting that you might need to do. Now, it'd be kind of a challenge to pull together the reporting from that archive that you have, that old database versus the new, the active one that you have, but it's certainly something that can be done. Now with 2013, of course, everything's all in the single database, so you would have to come up with some way to say, well, if I want to take that old database and still have it around so that I can do reporting against it to see what I did 5, 10 years ago, then you would have to have some mechanism for trying to choose how much of that data to keep in there. I suppose you could go through and delete the projects from the archive if you have them archived, so that essentially you're left with a shell of the projects, and then you have, of course, all that data surrounding them in the reporting database. We don't currently have a mechanism that truly allows you to archive projects in a way that just, you know, one click button that says, okay, we're done with these, you're not going to have to see them anywhere else, and maybe we'll keep some of the reporting information around for you, but we don't have that currently in the product. Yes, Kelvin. Sure.
The other mechanism is actually to generate an OLAP view manually at the end of each month, and actually then access the OLAP.
Right, yeah. And that's kind of the idea, too, behind the, I have the old database if I really want it, and I want to have that tons of stuff, I can generate an OLAP cube against that old data as well. So, yeah, that's another great idea that you can do. Okay, yeah, yeah. So you're kind of validating some of what I've said here. Yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, Brian.
The only thing I would add is after Mike's great demo at the keynote is that you can now use SSIS against Project Online in the OData service, and you could definitely pull the data through OData and do your own data warehouse for archiving and then cleaning up your PWA instance.
And you could use SSIS even if you're on-prem as well, if you wanted to sort of just unload the reporting data into some other sort of data warehouse. The point about the sort of deleting the project and you don't see it in reporting, we do sometimes get questions from customers where they say, well, I've deleted the project, but I still see it in reporting. When you dig into it, They're seeing it in the timesheet tables because, you know, we don't ever delete any stuff from the timesheet tables. You reported that you did 8 hours against that project. It's really more of an accounting record of those 8 hours. So you will still see the project name showing up in those particular records, but you shouldn't see them in the other normal project tables.
Thank you. Yes, in the back. In 2013? In 2013, it's the same as 2010 as far as the archiving. But as was just mentioned here, you certainly would have better tools for taking data kind of offline so that you could then have it archived for just the reporting information itself. But you probably have a lot of RBS set up, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
So then you get into another issue of performance.
True. Yeah. You know, with all of these solutions, it's something you're going to have to try out, and it may or may not work for you.
Sorry.
That was Efren. That wasn't me. I can say that 2013, we've done a lot of work in the performance side, especially around security, so that some of these scenarios where you have a lot of security categories set up and you have a deep RBS and so forth, those are going to work much better in 2013 versus 2010. We don't have anything like that. I mean, it's definitely a gap in the product and something that, you know, we haven't covered to this point.
One quick thing to add to what we're saying here, as far as the what Adrian had talked about with security categories and limiting what you can see. One thing between an active project and doing that is just have your project center views, have the normal project center views that people use, just have a filter on them on a field called active or a field called in progress or your phase or, you know, any number of those. And so have a default set of views that you have and the normal views that people use on an everyday basis for in progress projects, have them be filtered on that and then have the archive and then maybe the super secret and then give only certain people access to see those views. So you might get away from some of the issues with very detailed security categories and you know those deny categories that I like to come to the negative categories and try to do some of it with views. That might be one way of to getting around some of that.
See, there's a hand in the back and then we'll go to the microphone here and then over here. Yes. Yes, I can verify. Yeah.
I'm dreaming about, you're talking about...
But this is day, it's not night.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, for me it's night.
Yeah.
Dreaming about is for the security categories to be able to set it on a filter on an enterprise feed, for example, for a project feed. So the status field writes a chest to filter the fuse on. This field also to define what projects are member of a category. Because doing it manually on a monthly basis, on
this work,
would be great.
Yeah.
Chris, I have a spec written for that, by the way.
lots of specs coming out from this hour.
Well, the other ones were ideas for specs. I actually have it written.
Okay, I have two questions. One, with the second coming of SSRS, is performance point services back in the equation again in the long term, number one? And the second question is, a lot of customers want to, when they're doing the portfolio analysis, include running projects to see which ones they want to stop. And that is always a challenge. And I wonder what the best practice you've got around that and the impact on capacity planning.
Do you want me to take the first one?
Sure.
Seems kind of like a deadly one to say. I honestly don't know. I haven't heard any plans around performance point and where their direction is. I think in the keynote, we were showing off the Power BI stack quite a bit. And then that is probably the direction we will continue to head is in the Power BI space as that continues to grow and mature.
So before we had a question over here, I believe. So yeah.
We missed the second one.
Yeah. Well, you...
No, you asked two questions. Can we get the second one answered?
Okay, the second part?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Go ahead.
I don't know the answer.
Me?
I don't know.
Well, the portfolio analysis, if you want to include running projects and then optimize as to which one you can stop because you've got limited capacity.
I was going to say, do we have a portfolio analysis expert up here? If we don't, I would suggest reaching out to Luke Humphrey. He's at the booth. He would probably be the right guy on the engineering side to help answer that question for you.
So a feature that just one added is the right answer.
And Luke would be the guy who would write the spec for you. So I challenge Luke.
I will have a web with
it. Yeah. Let's go to the question that was right here first.
Yeah, it gets applied at the SQL tier. But to be brutally honest, the category permission thing, as a guy who owns Perf on the project team, is what I like the most, because putting it into its own category and having a single category for all your archived projects will actually get you the best bang for your buck in terms of archiving.
But it's two issues. One of them is whether you want to restrict update privileges, and you want to have it disappear from the real estate that users have to navigate, right?
Yeah, I agree. But it is getting filtered out right now.
We're back to the mood lighting.
Right at the SQL tier, so.
Yes, definitely we've had requests for things like that. I mean, it sounds like in the keynote we talked about, Ludo talked about, you know, resource management and that sort of thing, and it sounds like it's down that alley. There's a guy at the booth who definitely would like to hear what you would like to see, because he's planning all of that now to try to figure out what we will have in the future. His name is Jean. Jean is J-E-A-N. He's typically wearing a hat. So.
And on that one, I'm assuming you've tried, you know, things like elapsed duration, you know, assigning that guy to that task to an elapsed duration, or changing their calendar to a 24-hour calendar.
That's the big
it jacks up the work, obviously, but at least it shows them as 100% allocated on weekends. Right.
Right? But it also shows there's availability, which there really isn't. And that's the deal. They're on a 7x24 calendar. The resources are. The tasks are on like a 5-day, one shift type of scenario. So if you look, you get, hell, we've got all this excess capacity for this thing. You really don't.
Right. Just tell people not to do that. Next guy that assigns this task, this resource on the weekend gets fired. You're all set.
Okay, we had a question in the back, and then we have over on the side.
I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
Do
you want to come to the microphone?
When it comes to patches, CUs, and all that, like I always depend on Brian Smith's page. And now with the people have empowerment, anybody can put anything on the site, internet, it gets very tough for us to understand what is the best answer or the best information. Earlier, we used to have very limited number of pages where to go and find information. What is the current patch or current SP or CU? Now it gets like, you get 10,000 results coming back from internet. So
still just Brian's page.
I know that's what I'm depending upon. But there are other things that when we search for information, we need to, is there a way to identify the golden source of information on the product?
We have a bunch of doc people in the corner. Do you guys want to field this one?
Spending more time on identifying what solution is correct. I mean, that's becoming another profession. We need a person to search and identify what is the correct answer.
Yeah, one of the things, I mean, I use Bing as another search engine you might have heard of.
Brings only your page.
It does the same sort of thing, and I find that sometimes I'm searching for something, and a lot of the hits I'm finding are in the forums, because now that's where people are asking questions. And our MVPs and my colleagues are answering a lot of those questions. One of the things that we've been guilty of recently is we're not managing those forums as well as we had been in the past. And we are putting more resources into that to make sure not only that we're answering a greater proportion of the questions, but also going through and cleaning up to make sure that if we have answered it, then the moderator marks it as answered. So if somebody goes into that, you know, finds that as their number one search and goes to that thread, they can see that a Microsoft person has said that, yes, that is the answer. Because, you know, there's a lot of times there's not one right answer to something, and sometimes somebody will post something and you'll give them what you think the answer might be because you're not quite sure what they're asking.
You don't have all they've only told you half the story.
Yeah,
right?
And they never come back again to say whether that fixed it or didn't fix it. So sometimes we leave them as not sort of answered because we prefer the person that asked the question to say, yes, this answered it. But if they don't come back, then we'd like to at least validate what we think is the best answer on that thread, whether it's from an MVP or another customer or whatever. So we do need to do a lot more of that. There's a lot of good blogs out there.
The
blog rolls on my blog will point to lots of other ones.
Look for the knowledge base articles that come out every 2 weeks on the CUs, and that will have your information that you need there.
Yeah.
Does TechNet have that information? I don't see CUs SP2s and TechNet. I mean,
if you go to the project support blog where we do the announcement at the CU, on there we've got the KB article, and you click through to the KB article, it will list what's fixed in this KB article. Sometimes you have to click through because if you've got a roll-up KB, it may include several others. So you have to sort of click through to the project server
it's an easy way to find that information. Like you keep clicking through multiple things to get to one.
Yeah, it is a common question that I've been asked more than once already this last few days is, okay, but it's cumulative, so how do I know what else is in there without going back to December's and October's and August's and June? And that's something that we're trying to get our head around, you know, is there a good answer to that? Because you know, potentially we could sort of gather that together in one sort of long-running article, and the guys over in the corner will be, you know, having discussions with them on how we surface some of this stuff. But the tricky bit always is how do we get the right information in the KB? And Adrian does a lot of the sort of editing of what goes into there, so that it's actually meaningful to somebody. Because we want it to sort of tell you what the problem is that we fixed, but it's sometimes very difficult in a sentence or two sentences to really sum up whether that's something that the average person is going to run into, or it's a sort of a 1 in 100,000. If it's a certain phase of the moon and the planets are in line, then you might see this problem. You know, some of them are like that. They, you know, you might read the KB and think, oh, you know, this is falling to pieces. But in reality, it's a very sort of set scenario where that kind of thing will happen. So it's getting that balance of getting all the right information out there without sort of scaring everybody with this huge long list of things that we've fixed since RTM.
One thing on the forums that he talked about, and there are some people, some moderators on there that some of the MVPs and some of the Microsoft people, they go through and will mark those things. One thing though, when you're going through and you get that thread and maybe it hasn't been marked, but you can go through and you can see there's been 10 answers in this thread. There is a score for a user. They do a scoring system, mm-hmm. and if somebody has higher the score, the more that their answers have been marked as correct, either by Microsoft or by the user. So you can kind of you can do some judgment of if there's an answer that sounds really good, but that, you know, it might be right, but the person only has like zero, and somebody else kind of directly contradicts it, but they have a score of like 30,000, you know, then. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's, but it's a rule of thumb that, sure, you can use to judge that and kind of for yourself kind of decide which one of those is more likely to be correct.
Yeah, of course, I'm testing it.
So it sounds like as far as the knowledge base articles, we could probably do a little bit better, and I've been trying to do some things myself to make them different here recently, trying to put a little bit more scenario into the description itself so you can tell, is this really my issue versus, you know, project may crash. Well, sure, there are 10 bazillion things that could cause that, you know, and so we want to try to focus it on to the exact thing that causes that crash, so you'll know whether or not this fix will be the right thing for you. And as far as a cumulative roll-up type article, that's something we'll need to discuss. So your second question?
Yeah. Other question is actually, so we use 2010, project 2010, SP2, SEM mode. So one of the timesheet issue, like you have a task, you have three people assigned to a task, you published it, it's available to all the three team members, and first person goes in, like for example, it's a task of 1 month, 4 weeks, for example, and first person who gets onto the timesheet, who is like, who spent on Friday, the time on Friday of the first week, and all other three people haven't booked their timesheet yet. Okay. He submits the timesheet, the timesheet manager approves it, it goes back into the project, and when the project is republished, the time, start date, goes into the start of Friday. If second person goes in, he worked on Monday, it won't let him book time from Monday onwards, saying that, you're already like, think about it's second week. First week, the first guy who booked the timesheet, first week he's on vacation, he didn't book the time on that. He started the second week, he entered the time for the second week. So project, when he submits the project, it takes the start date as the scheduled start date also is moved to the first person who books the time. First person who books the time, actual date, scheduled start date is also moved. So when the project is republished for everybody, all the other three people also, the project is taken out, saying that, oh, start date is second week, first date is not there, so all the other people won't see the project. So they have to go and insert task and reinsert. So that's kind of like, most of the times, 80 to 90% of the times, getting the timesheet, getting to people book their time properly is a big headache, and if they have to go and insert a task and do all that, it adds up more. So is there a solution for that, like to hold that schedule start date the way project manager planned?
Well, first off, if you have people reporting outside of the dates of the task, then Why is that? Is that something?
It's within the. Like, for example, sure. A task is a 4 week. First week, the first person didn't work.
Yes.
He started the second week.
Sure.
He booked that second week. But the first actual start date of the task is the second week.
Right.
And when it is posted back to the project, it thinks that is the start date. The first person right. who booked it is the start date.
Yes.
And push the whole schedule to that start date.
But typically, it would push out the assignment start date. And so sometimes the task will say, okay, this is the same thing that would happen within project itself. It would say, well, you know, since I'm a resource effort-driven task, why do I have something scheduled way back there? And so it would move it out. So, I mean, it sounds like something we need to just look at a little bit better to say, in these circumstances, is there a different way that we could apply the updates so that we keep the task exactly the way it was? But then on the flip side, you could have some people who say, well, why is the task still scheduled back there? You know, because this guy, he put his work here, and the other people are going to come in 3 weeks later and report their work, so therefore I do want the task to start here. So, I mean, I can see that the situation both going both ways, where in some cases you would want the behavior that you're seeing right now versus what you have. You don't want to see it work that way, and so we'd have to try to figure out a better way to do that, perhaps.
But even before we get to that, is it possible that there's a problem that the timesheet or the status manager, the timesheet manager is, or in this case, the status manager, would be maybe prematurely accepting the updates and publishing the schedule before? So the first person put their time in, the status manager, so it's Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, the project manager goes in there, accepts their time, perhaps, even though the second two people or the second three people still had time to enter that week, but they didn't get there, it might be a less of a technical issue and more of a process issue that perhaps the project manager or the status manager might need to hold up a little bit and wait until then there's the idea of how do you know that, but it's maybe be a little slower on the draw for that, because that's when you do that again, it's gonna change the actual start date of the task, and it might move stuff out. But if he had waited perhaps and waited until after the other three had done it, we wouldn't have had that problem.
That's because
perhaps.
When it comes in, it'll be one update typically, and it'll all be merged together, and so it'll know about all three of the people coming in, so it'll do the right
scheduled,
thing.
Right? You already scheduled. I mean, if you really go and see the task usage view, everybody across for all 4 weeks, all four guys who is going to work on it, you will see the planned work for all 4 weeks. So the planned work is there for each of those days in the week. So, I mean, there are so many things that can be done process-wise.
Yeah.
Then I don't need a scheduling engine.
But I think this, in this case, from what you've described, it sounds as though the status manager may have you can approve the timesheet, but then opening it up into project and republishing the project after each time someone submits a status update, that can end up being problematic and produce what you're talking about.
That's one scenario you're explaining, but there may be other scenarios. I mean, the other three guys have...
No, there's just the one.
Doesn't...
I don't know if there's a direct solution here right now. Obviously, it sounds like there are different ways to think through the problem. And what Brian has said sounds like one that I talked about recently here with a customer where it was almost the exact same situation. It's like, well, you know that these other updates are going to be coming in, so why don't you wait for them to come in and then publish the project at that point? Or
because they have project manager republish OCD.
Yeah, so, something like that.
It's,
anyway,
it's a common problem.
Yeah. Okay. What's that? Sure, one reason. Yeah, that makes a big, long project as well. So, I mean, there's not a beautiful solution to all of this, and there are going to be drawbacks and benefits to probably any of them that you choose.
I think this person over here had one more. I'm sorry.
We have about 10 minutes.
So we don't have to let go here.
We can talk afterwards, too, if you'd like. Sure.
I had one more, but... Yeah,
okay,
I can
let's go here.
Perfect.
And then we'll see how
we'll
things
get you
go.
After.
Yeah.
Project and are
I think the question was that in the past, or maybe even now, that you would have kind of in-flight timesheets, some timesheets that had not been fully accepted, and the project was deleted, and then at that point, then you could no longer accept the updates to those timesheets, is that correct? You couldn't accept them?
Suddenly rejected. So when the task was deleted, the project was deleted.
It was an issue with RTM for 2013 and it is solved.
We are using still 2010.
Okay.
And single entry mode and fixed approval routing.
Time to upgrade.
I don't know.
Super.
No, it's from. Yeah, is this something that you've talked to the support team about? Okay. Well, I mean, I'm not sure. Without having more information and without trying a few things myself, I can't tell you what the answer is. But this sounds like something that obviously is affecting you, and you should probably open up a support incident and work it through. And if it is something that we've addressed, then certainly we can point you toward that fix. If it isn't something that has been addressed, then we could perhaps work towards that as well. So,
Okay, but the normal case will be that the timesheet, when a timesheet is approved, then all time entered there remains on it.
Yes.
Regardless of deleting the task, the project is, okay.
Yes.
And nowadays we had some issues with timesheet has multiple lines on it, tasks. All tasks are approved by the status managers, but timesheet is not visible in the approval center of the timesheet manager of that resource. This happens nowadays sometimes, I don't know why, and after then, if I try to record the timesheet, suddenly it shows that a task is awaiting approval. Normally, a timesheet cannot the state cannot be submitted when the tasks are not approved.
I mean, it sounds like you're in single entry mode.
Yes.
Okay.
Single entry mode in a fixed approval routing, 2010 project server.
Okay. Yeah, I can't, you know, Brian and I were just kind of chatting here on the side, but I think there's more we'd have to know about it and to understand to really know what the answer is to your problem there.
Okay. That is still annoying because we've been a few hundred timesheets and and 10, 20 timesheets are nothing. Nobody sees that. This is
getting a ticket in and getting them your getting them your information and possibly getting them your database. They're going to be able to dig in there and really see it for you.
And I have already looked with the PSI. I've written a PowerShell script. All is okay. I have also looked in the published database and in the reporting database. All tasks are set to approved. Then I record the timesheet, and then they change back to pending approval.
And I know there is a bug one of my colleagues is looking at the moment where there's a timing issue between some of the SPROCs when you sort of accept timesheets and accept updates, and we can end up pushing the wrong status for the timesheet through to the reporting database, because it sort of hits that SPROC before it gets the sort of final approval. So we end up with a zero in the reporting database where we should have a four. Now, that wouldn't affect whether it appears on the approvals or not, but as we said, the best thing is to open an incident. Whenever you open an incident, if it comes down to being a bug, then you either won't pay for it or you get refunded or whatever. And this sounds like a bug. So, I mean, never be afraid to open a support call thinking it's going to cost you when you think you found a bug, because you may well have done.
Okay, and another question, will in the future it be able to set the status manager on an assignment, because currently the status manager is on the assignment. Currently I can read the assignment, the status manager only on an assignment, but have to write on the task with PowerShell.
Right.
Will in the future...
in the past it was that way. In 2003, you could set it at the assignment level. It changed in 2007. Something we could discuss perhaps in the future for changing it back. I don't know. But I don't know what the plans are, and we'd have to talk through that.
Because the query is select top one. When I read the timesheet, the status manager from an assignment.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There, I thought maybe in the future this, but the programming behavior is strange. I have to read on the assignment
and
write on the task.
Yeah. Well, that's good feedback. Knew that had changed, and there are definitely some reasons why it was done that for simplification, stuff like that. But obviously, there are reasons why it would be good to have a status manager per assignment, because you have potentially more than one project manager who are controlling that one task, and so that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's move on to right here.
Yeah. And very then quick, very easy breezy, nothing so complex.
Easy breezy.
Thanks for the great work on the out-of-the-box reporting on 2013. Absolutely phenomenal. The question I had was, every status update has some talking points. The charts look wonderful, but there's always a small story to be told. That is not very text-friendly. I mean, it's the reports. To insert text in there is it's not friendly at all. Are there any plans or is there a way around it where it gets easier to... And I've heard even PowerView, there are some challenges in getting text in there, because we always have some talking points to give at the end of the week for every status update.
Which report are you talking about?
The project summary report, out of the box. Project overview, sorry.
You just want to have random text boxes you can put around
just,
or whatever.
Exactly. So we say, hey, you know, these are the risks. Just because people read it, the numbers say, I mean, the charts do give a picture, but there's always, you know, they want to hear from the project manager, so...
I don't know. Sounds like a good feature request.
Think there's one at the back.
I can stand. That's okay. In your out-of-box reporting, do you have, for multiple projects that have dependencies across projects, sort of a risk summary reporting? Because we've got tons of projects with dependencies, and it's really difficult for us to say, oh my gosh, there's five projects that have two dependencies on two other projects, and we can analyze it. We're just talking and figuring that out individually.
I'm not aware of it. I mean, the out-of-box reports definitely would not do that. There's what was displayed today, where you could see the critical paths and that sort of thing. That can work across projects, but of course that requires that you have everything open and so forth, and it doesn't really help you filter it down to maybe exactly what you want to see.
And I would ask if you're using deliverables feature that ties those dependencies. And I think that report is actually built in there, so it identifies the deliverables. So if you've got them tagged already, it should show up.
So these are some things you can do out of the reporting database to kind of look at that and
customize it.
To create a report that would kind of highlight that for you. Now, it might not, you know, speak to the riskiness of you know, you talked about it being a risk report.
Yeah.
If you mean real risk, it might not be very easy to have it
to
speak to how far off the critical path in their other project
that's
it is.
What we're it becomes more
difficult to do that. But a lot of that information is there. It's just it can be a little difficult. And I think there are some vendors downstairs, I think, that have some reporting that starts to address that.
Great. Thanks.
There was one in the back, right?
One in the back. Yeah, so going back a little to the archiving discussion, one of the situations I often run into helping more immature PMOs is, you know, there's always a subset of project managers that kind of have a dog ate my homework problem, where they don't necessarily want to admit that, you know, they didn't, you know, save and publish at a certain time, or may have put in the wrong information. Besides keeping, let's say, 30 days of archive database, or doing what I often do, which is occasionally dumping everything into Excel so you can sit down with them and go through their history, are there any other creative approaches that you guys have seen to sort of history of projects, and especially around project quality, or, you know, not full audit trail, but almost, you know, semi-looking at that type of functionality?
It doesn't directly answer your question, but just a comment on the archiving. When you said 30 days of archives, the archive actually works on changes. So if you set it to 30, it will be the last 30 times it changed on a different day. So we don't
30 versions.
Yeah, I just to, sometimes people get the two confused. But.
There's some tool vendors downstairs that have some snapshotting capabilities that will look at that and be able to let you schedule, you know, every Friday save these 10 fields on all the projects to a database. And so I think there's some vendors downstairs that do that. It might be something to take a look at.
Thanks.
I think we're out of time. I appreciate all of you coming. I'm sorry if you didn't get your question in. I thank their esteemed group here.